Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Four, three, two, one. Welcome to Strong Tower Radio's Good Growing with the Garden Guy. And I'm your host, Tom Majeure, and my sister Sue down in Kalamazoo. Welcome back, Sue.
It's good to be here.
And we have our subject matter expert, Gary Heilig, on the line. Gary's, you're in Eaton Rapids, Michigan, correct?
I am today.
You are today. All right. Okay. Hey, Sue, why don't you have a word of prayer for us, and let's get started.
Okay. Heavenly Father, thank you for this opportunity to learn more about what you created and how it affects us and how it can bring us closer to you while we learn about it, and for this blessing that it may bring to many people. In your name, amen.
Amen. Well, Sue, this happens to be the January Good Growing with the Garden Guy, and do you have any thoughts as we start the new year of gardening?
I'm thinking it's a plotting and planning time of year.
So you say plotting and planning. Okay, very good. Well, Gary, is that the right answer?
Yeah, I think so, because it's too cold to be doing a whole lot outside right now.
Well, good. Gary, you like to start us off often with a quiz. So are you going to treat us again?
Oh, yeah. I have some questions. Some things about apricots. And the first thing is, where do they generally believe apricots originated?
Everything does seem to come from China, doesn't it?
Yeah, they think it's from northeastern China near the Russian border. In Armenia, it has been growing them since ancient times. They've discovered very old seeds in the country. And when do you think it came to the United States?
I have no idea.
Some explorer or somebody or other was eating them or had the seeds or something.
Well, the Spanish explorers introduced them to North America. My next question is, who do you think produces the most apricots? What's the leading country?
I think Turkey, because they always say Turkish apricots on all these packages, the dried ones, I mean.
Turkey's number one, although I tend to like California apricots better. They tend to be a little bit more tart, and I just prefer that. And then Uzbekistan is another big, they're the second highest producer, than Italy, Algeria, Iran. And the United States is quite far down. They're number 21. And what states do you think would be the top producers?
It's got to be California.
Oh, yeah. California's number one for sure. The second two might not be so obvious.
Well, maybe New Mexico.
Nope.
Arizona.
It's out of my ballpark. I would say Georgia.
All right, let's think of another big producing state of fruit.
Florida.
Washington.
Yeah, Washington, and then Utah, which I would have never thought that Utah would have been a big place to apricots. So those are the main places that apricots are produced in the United States.
What about the
next one?
What about the nutritional value? What about the nutritional value of apricots while we're on the subject?
Well, I didn't necessarily look it up, but they certainly are a source of vitamin C and potassium, because as when we talk about potassium fertilizer a little bit later, all the stone fruits are heavier in terms of their uptake of potassium. So that's something else that you would get from them. Since they're also orange, you're going to get some vitamin A from them. in terms of minerals like calcium and magnesium and selenium and things, I'd have to look that up. So maybe I'll try to remember to do that next month.
How does what is your fascination in apricots?
I just love apricots. I love to eat them dried, and apricot preserves are one of my favorites.
I do like those.
Now, I don't eat munchkins very often because they only come out at certain times of the year. But there was a place here in Lansing. One was Quality Dairy, and the other was an Italian place. I can't remember the name of it right now. But those are the only two places that you could get apricot-filled punchkis. And I thought those were like the best. But now nobody has them. So they're quite rare. I may have to start making them myself.
I'm just wondering.
But anyway, I just love the flavor. And when I used to make cheesecakes, now I make more healthy foods. But when I used to make cheesecakes, I used to like to make an apricot glaze to go on the top.
No.
So it wasn't actually a glaze. It was actually apricots that were like a spread, and it was really good because I like that tart flavor, and it kind of cut some of the sugar from the a cheesecake.
Probably.
I haven't made a cheesecake in probably a decade, so they're not the healthiest things to eat. Maybe once a year, that's about the maximum I would eat it now. Okay, the next question is, what's the most grown flower in the United States?
I know you love roses, but...
Yeah, I vote for that, too.
Yeah, roses is it. It's the most popular, not only in the United States, probably the world. And, of course, we know most of the roses are sold around Valentine's Day. Now, see if you get this one. What's the number one selling annual flower in the U.S.?
Annual flower.
Mm-hmm. Well... Seems like you see either petunias or begonias or impatiens in beds a lot.
Marigolds are there, too.
Oh, not as much, I don't think, as they used to.
All right, I'm going to give you a hint. It starts with a P.
Petunias.
Yep, that's it. Petunias. Now, what is the most popular perennial in the U.S.?
Tulips.
Hostas.
No.
Daylilies.
What do you think? Pardon?
Daylilies.
That's right. Daylilies is the most popular perennial. Now, this next one, this last question, doesn't have so much to do with plants, but... has to do with sugar. Now, when you eat fruit, there's a sugar in it called fructose. But when you buy sugar, like put in coffee or tea or to sweeten something, that's actually sucrose. And I think there's some fructose in it. But how many pounds of sugar do you think the average U.S. citizen consumes a year compared to 1900?
Well, it's very significantly increased. Are you just looking at percentages?
How much do you think it is in pounds?
We're probably, I'll say 50 pounds per year.
I think
it's
more.
Well, I can help you out a little bit. In 1900, it was 90.
We like sugar.
Yeah, America does like sugar.
It's hard to say. I mean, 90 pounds is such a huge amount. I hate to even guess at how much more we might be eating now.
We are considering all sources of sugar. Fruits. You have sugar in vegetables. You have sugar in breads. So processed foods have a lot of sugar in them. But give me a guess.
It would seem very wild to say 200 pounds.
What do you think, Sue?
I'm thinking a half or two-thirds again as much.
It is 150 to 170. So it's a range that they have. So it's not quite double, but it's getting there on the high side. That's a lot of sugar. The reason I put that in there, I'm looking at how our body metabolizes different things like sugar. And it's extremely interesting if you like biochemistry, which I really did like biochemistry in school. I just threw that in there. But it's all sugar, because you get sugar from sweet corn, you get sugar from tomatoes, you get sugar from fruits. If you eat an apple or a plum or a pear, the primary sugar in there is. Now, the downside to fructose is your body can only process it in your liver, and it goes right to storage, like to fat. Glucose, your body uses it, and it only turns it into fat if you have too much in your bloodstream. So, anyway, let's move on. What do you want to do next, Tom?
Okay. For some reason, I was looking at some of the abbreviations here, and I thought you had put walnuts, so I thought we were going to talk about walnuts today. But anyway, hey, listen, let's talk about this month. What should we be thinking about? Sue talked about plotting and planting. Maybe give us some guidelines on plotting and planting.
Well, obviously, there's not a lot you can do in the garden during the winter months. There will be some pruning that you can start doing if it's not too cold, and I'll talk a little bit about how to make that more comfortable later. But the types of things that I'm doing right now, I just went through all of my seeds. I did an inventory check to find out what I needed to order, and I already have my orders in, so I pretty much finished that. And when I checked my seeds, I not only looked for what I needed, but were there any seeds that were outside of the longevity list in terms of how long the seeds last. And if you store seeds in ideal conditions, like and dry, then, say, for instance, broccoli or cauliflower could last up to 6 years, whereas onion seeds will only last 1 year. So since I had COVID when I was supposed to plant my garden this year, my onion seeds all had to be thrown out because they just didn't germinate. And I went through and looked at every single thing. I did what vegetable seeds I was going to keep. Now, flower seeds, they do have longevity charts. They're not as complete as they are for vegetables. But when I'm in doubt, I'll do what's called a germination check, and you can do that at any time, to find out how fast they germinate and how quickly they grow. And we've talked about this in the past, but basically you take 10 seeds, put them in between a moist paper towel, put that inside of a baggie, and set it on something that's rather warm, like maybe on top of the refrigerator or the hot water heater or something like that, and see how many of them come out in the 14 days. And if you see them come out and they're growing rather quickly, then those seeds will still be good here. Another thing that is good to do is actually plan what you want to do. It's your flower bed or how you want to lay out your vegetable garden based on what you planted where this last year. Or even if you want to do container gardens for your deck or your that, you can start gathering your ideas. And you can go down to your local bookstore and look at some of the gardening magazines. Or you can go to online. Just look up pictures of container gardens or vegetable garden layouts. There's just all good information out there. Give you an idea of what combination of plants you can do, color schemes, heights. There's just so much you can do now, especially with the internet. They just have all kinds of pictures. And then the other thing you can start doing now is collecting containers. If you don't want to spend the money going down to some of the hydroponic stores and buying the flats, which are kind of nice, but they do cost money, and you can save things like paper towel or toilet paper rollers, and there's you can cut four slits in the bottom and put in like you do on a box and make yourself a little container. Or when I would go to Wendy's and buy a salad, they had some nice strong plastic containers that can be used for containers. If you wanted to grow larger transplants like a tomato or something, I would keep soup containers that you get from, say, a Chinese restaurant. You just drill a few drainage holes in the bottom, and you can use those for containers. So you start collecting those now so that you'll have enough when you really need them.
That's very
interesting. Then another thing you can do, if you just can't wait, is start making your own potting soil if you want to save on some cost. And what you can do is put one-third vermiculite, one-third perlite, and one-third dust, or you can actually put in some finished compost in there if you want. And like I'd mix in some of my worm compost that I have in the basement, and you can save some money on potting soil because prices of everything are going up. And then in my case, I have a little greenhouse, and I think I've talked about that before. I will be going out to the greenhouse. I've taken out some of the gravel and I put it in the driveway, and as soon as it's warm enough, I'll get a delivery of gravel. I'm going to put some pea gravel in there, my little tables, get everything ready so that when I'm ready to start planting, the greenhouse will be ready, which I'll start putting things in there. I'll start things in the house or in the basement under lights in February. I'll just keep on going until I start using the greenhouse, which will be late March.
What good advice. Thank you so much for that.
It's a good time of year to start a bonsai because it's in. You could do it indoors.
Oh, you can start bonsai anytime. You can buy the plants, and you can even find little bonsai kits where you can start from seed. But I would prefer to start with a plant because seeded plants take much longer for them to get to the point where you can actually start training them. And there are shows every now and then that you can go see. You can find them online. And when you see some of these bonsai plants that are 100 years old or 200 years old, every once in a while they'll program where they'll bring them in from Japan, put them on display. It's like looking at this huge tree that's a little miniature, usually not more than a couple of feet tall. And they're really interesting to see. It's worthwhile.
Yes.
It takes patience to grow them, and you really need an artistic eye also. You have to be able to see the overall form of what you're trying to achieve, and the only way you're going to do that is by looking at what other people have done and learn how to wrap the branches with the wire and put them in the pose and to make them look. That's what you're trying to do. Is make a young plant look like it's much older.
You know, in Grand Rapids, when we lived there at the Meyer Garden, they used to have an annual bonsai exhibit. I don't know if that's still going on, but our listeners may want to look up and probably on the calendar on their website to see if they have that, and probably just about every major city has a bonsai club or somebody who likes to display once a year, because that's half the fun, is showing off your creation and looking at others, I'm sure.
And if you want to get into that hobby, it's best to start it while you're young. Let's say if you started in your 20s and you live to be, say, 80, you'll get a good years of growth on your trees. So you'll see the results of all of that effort. But I'm going to be 69 by the end of the month. This would not be the time to start bonsai. Now, this would be the time to buy them. Time to try to start that hobby.
And you know, Gary, you make a good point here. Is would this be something that... If you or I are at that age, that we could maybe help maybe a grandchild get started on that, and it's almost a gift, a bequeath to them?
Yeah, you certainly could do that. That would be a nice project that you could start with a grandchild or even a great-grandchild and if they do it, because it's the kind of a hobby, it's a lifetime hobby. You don't just forget about it for a while, because as they grow, one of the ways you keep them dwarfed is the roots have to be constricted in the container. So there's root pruning that has to be done. There's wiring that has to be done in order to get the branches to stay in that position that will make a young tree look like a much older tree. And it's the kind of thing that when it needs attention, you have to give it that attention. You can't forget about it while you're a teenager and you're playing sports in high school and I'm just not getting around to it. Well, then you're just going to lose it.
Well, what a great answer, and I'm glad that we took off on that path. Well, listeners, we've completed segment one of three of Good Growing with the Garden Guy here on Strong Tower Radio with your host Tom and Sue Majeure. Stay tuned. We will be right back.
The Bible and God's character are under attack like never before. Here at Strong Tower Radio, we are proud to hold up the Bible as a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path. We believe the Bible is the Word of God and contains the good news of God's character and His great plan of salvation for mankind. If you know and believe this to be true, won't you help Strong Tower Radio proclaim the truth about our God and His Word, the Bible? To do that, go to www.strongtowerradio.org. And there, on our secure website, you will find a donate button. Click on that and give as the Lord directs. Thank you for listening and supporting Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
Folks, The Good Growing with the Garden Guy is back, a Strong Tower Radio monthly feature with your hosts, Tom and Sue Majeure. We are continuing our exploration of nutrients. When you go to pick up your fertilizers, there are three numbers that are on every one of those bags that tells you about the nutrients in that. And so, Gary, refresh our memories on what those three elements are.
Well, the first one is nitrogen, which we talked about in November. The second one is phosphorus, which we talked about last month. And this month we're talking about the third one, which is potassium, and people also call it potash. So I wanted to start out asking you a question. Who do you think is the leading producer of potash in the world?
Well, I'm going to have to guess that it's Canada.
Wow, pretty good. I'm impressed. They account for about 31% of the world's production. And the top three countries is Canada, Russia, and Belarus, which Belarus is part of the old Soviet Union. And then China, and then Germany. And the United States is number nine. Now, those first three countries account for about 70% of the world's potash production. So where do you think our sources are here in the United States?
I would hope it would be closer to home, which would be Canada.
No, in the United States.
Oh, in the United States.
Well, there are two states that we particularly get our potash from, and they both have been mentioned today.
Really? Okay. I think they're out west, and it seemed like when I was in Utah or somewhere out there, there was different mining for different products, if not Wyoming.
You're right about Utah. And then the other one was mentioned earlier for some other question, New Mexico. And we used to produce as much as 850,000 tons a year, but that was back in like 2014. But we've dropped down to 480,000 tons a year, which at a time when there's a greater demand for fertilizer in the world, we're actually decreasing production here in the United States. And who do you think is the largest consumer of potash on the planet?
That's got to be agriculture.
Yes, but what country?
I don't have a clue.
Sue, any idea?
Things with potassium. Okay, well, maybe.
I'm going to give you a hint. It's the largest population in the world.
China.
China, yeah, China. They're the largest population in the world now, but they're going to be taken over by Nigeria in a very short time.
Really?
But anyway, so why is potassium so important? Well, in the plant itself, in order for it to be able to efficiently use the nitrogen that it picks up, the potassium is really important in that process. And also, it helps the plant to use water efficiently. And it also helps the plant withstand drought tolerance, which goes along with the whatever water it has, it uses it efficiently. It helps with frost resistance. So a lot of times when we're concerned about plants making it through the winter months, we certainly want to be sure that the potassium levels in the soil are sufficient. And also, just like if we don't get the right vitamins and minerals in our diet, we're more likely to get sick. Potassium plays a role in the plant being able to resist insect pests and certain diseases. So if you haven't run a soil test and your potassium's really low, you're more likely to have pest problems in your vegetable garden. So are you interested in how it's made?
Sure. Hey, I got one question before we go to that. We use it for agriculture. What in industry competes for this limited resource?
Well, I wouldn't say compete because agriculture is number one, but potassium is used for other things. It's used in industrial processes. It's also used in medicine. I have a potassium chloride pill that I take because one of the medications I take actually will take potassium out of my body. And there is a balance between sodium and potassium in your body, and if it gets too out of whack, it can give you heart problems. So I call it my fertilizer pill because it's potassium chloride, which is the version of potassium that you find in the fertilizer bag, potassium chloride. And so it's used in a lot of different things. Like I said, medicine is just an example. Now, there's also different types of potassium. For instance, I mentioned potassium chloride that you find in the fertilizer bag. But that's not a friendly source of potassium to all plants. For instance, blueberries don't particularly like that. They like a different form of potassium called potassium sulfate. And so that's 0050 if you were buying it in the store. And that's what we call an acidifying fertilizer because it has sulfur in it, and that tends to drive down your pH, which is what blueberries and certain other plants like. You still awake, Tom?
Oh, I sure am.
Because some people glaze over when you start talking about soil chemistry, but it's really interesting. And what they do, the way they get it, there are a number of different ways, but one of the ways is to get potassium chloride, for instance, is they inject hot water deep down into the ground to dissolve a mineral called sylvinite, which contains potassium. And then they bring that brine back up to the surface. And remember, the two states where it's produced is in New Mexico and Utah, and they're both hot states. So they allow what they call solar evaporation, and then that gets rid of all the water, and what's left is the potash salts that are then used in fertilizers. And then there are other ways that you can make potassium fertilizers by mixing certain chemicals together. For instance, potassium sulfate can be extracted from a mineral called langbeinite, which probably nobody's ever heard of before. And or they can synthesize it by taking potassium chloride, which is a salt, and treating it with sulfuric acid at high temperatures. and that will make it. And they can also react another chemical called potassium hydroxide with sulfuric acid, and you can get certain forms of potassium that plants can use also. But it's an essential nutrient. It's what we call a macronutrient. The nitrogen, the phosphorus, and potassium are needed in high amounts compared to, say, something like a micronutrient, which means it's needed in very small amounts, like manganese might be needed in 1 or 2 pounds per acre. And an acre is 43,560 square feet, whereas nitrogen might be needed at 90 to 110 pounds per acre. And that's why they call them macronutrients.
You mentioned the decrease in the U.S. production from 800,000.
Down to about, well, it was 850 down to about 480.
Did they indicate the reason? Is there any indication of why the production has dropped?
When I was doing the research on it, it didn't say why. It could be the demand has dropped somewhat, or they've been able to import it cheaper from other places. There are a number of possibilities. So if a company goes out of business, then for some reason, then production is going to naturally go down. But I didn't see why that is. But if you're really interested, I'll do some digging on it.
Well, God.
I always like to have things come from our country as much as possible because it means jobs for people here in the United States. And then you're not dependent on importing it. And you can see what happened with the situation in Ukraine when Europe and the United States started boycotting Russian oil, and then the Russians stopped exporting fertilizer, and it just caused a mess for the whole world because people start to get a little stingy with their resources. So it's nice if you have your own source, and that way you're not hurt as badly when these conflicts pop up.
So we've talked about the macronutrients. What is up next?
Well, next month I'm going to talk about what pH is and why that's important, and we'll talk about how important organic matter is. We've talked a little bit about organic matter, but we'll probably go into more detail next month. And what I'm doing each month, I'm trying to talk a little bit about soil chemistry so that people can understand where these things come from, what they do, and what you can do to make your garden healthier. And, of course, in the lesson from this is it is important that we run a soil test at least every 3 years to find out what our nutrient levels are. Because when you grow something on your garden or in your garden, it's always extracting nutrients out of the soil. Some nutrients move down through the soil profile over time, and certain plants, like shallow-rooted plants, won't be able to reach those nutrients, and they're down too deep. And that's one of the reasons why we move things around in our garden, because a tomato can get roots down 6 feet. So if a nutrient gets down that far, it can bring it right back up to the surface, especially if you recycle what's left over at the end of the season. But and there are differences in terms of what the plants take out. For instance, I grow fruit here on my property, and the pome fruits, which are things like quince and apples and pears, they require a soil test level of phosphorus or potassium of 140 to 160 pounds equivalent. Now, if you're looking on a soil test report that you get from MSU now, they report it in parts per million. And to convert that to parts per million, you just divide by two. So for parts per million on a MSU soil test, you'd want to have between 70 and 80 parts per million to grow apples and pears and that. But stone fruits require more. They require 200 to 240 pounds, whereas something like sweet corn needs about 150. So you really need to know what your levels are if you want to be sure you have the optimal levels for good growth of your plants.
That's good to know. What should we be thinking about next?
Well, one of the things I thought about is during the winter months, people don't go out to their compost piles because it's cold. They don't want to go out there and fool around with it. So I had this question. What do you do with compostable kitchen waste during the winter months? And during the winter, when you're making salads or you're eating bananas or if you peel your apples, all these different types of things, or maybe you have some salad left over in the refrigerator and it goes, it's not very attractive to eat anymore. What do you do with this stuff? Most people just throw it in the garbage and forget about it. But a lot of people, what they will do is save those compostable materials and they'll add the material to the garden later. Now, there are a couple of things you can do, and we've talked about this before. You can start a worm composting bin, and I have 55-gallon garbage cans that I bought at Home Depot or Lowe's, and I recycle any potting soils that I might use in container gardens on my porch or on my deck. And so I'll put the material in there, a layer of it in there, in the container, and then I'll put just enough soil over it so that it doesn't cause any smell. And then after that, those little red worms that we talked about in the past will eat all of that. And they'll, when they process it through their bodies, the nutrients coming out of the back end are perfect for plants. And over the course of the year, I could fill up one of those 55-gallon garbage cans. And I prefer plastic so that the metal ones don't rust or anything. And then I'll take that out and I'll put it in a container or raised bed or just spread it on the surface of the garden before I till. Another thing you can do, like for instance, if I just have a banana and I just ate a banana yesterday, I have some begonias that I saved from my mom's house. I took cuttings and they need to be root potted. And what I'll do is I'll just stick a banana peel in the bottom of the pot, put my potting soil over top of it, and plant the plant. And as that breaks down, those nutrients will be recycled. Now, obviously, you can't do that all the time because you only repot every now and then, but it's one of the options you can deal with. Another thing you can do is just get yourself a small container, just like a small metal garbage can with a top that you can close and good, and then just simply put it outside the back door and then just dump your stuff in there and close it up. And that way raccoons and those types of things can't get into it. Now, it'll freeze during the winter. It'll be a liquid mush in the spring. But you can dig a hole and just pour it in. And all those nutrients will be recycled, and you won't believe how the plants will grow when you put something on top of that. And I've seen gardens where people have really raised the organic matter level in their soil, and the plants were just beautiful. So those are different things that you can do. Some people don't want to mess with it. They'll just say, I'm not going through that trouble. I'm just going to throw the stuff away. But I've seen people that have done that recycling of their organic waste from the kitchen over 25 years, and their soil was just beautiful. And a good garden always starts with a good quality soil. And if you live in a subdivision where your topsoil was sold, over time, you need to rebuild it back up if you want to be able to grow plants without problems.
Absolutely. Well, folks, you've been listening to Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilig. I'm your host, Tom and Sue Majeure, and we will be back after this break.
Hi, folks. Jelaine Fenner here. We are definitely living in uncertain times, and for some of us, it's scary. Signs of the times are everywhere. Jesus is coming back soon. Read Revelation chapter 22. Jesus says, "Surely I am coming quickly." We at Strong Tower Radio have a free book for you called The Great Controversy. Go to the back of the book and read chapters 35 to 42. It'll help you understand the times we're living in and what's ahead. This book even has 800 historical quotes and 1,200 Bible quotes. I love this book. Call Strong Tower Radio today, 231-468-2087, and ask for The Great Controversy while supplies last. And if we don't answer, please leave a message asking for The Great Controversy with your name, address, and phone number. That's 231-468-2087 on Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
Well, folks, Gary and Tom and Sue are back with the last segment of Good Growing with the Garden Guy. No, Gary, a number of people are, snowbirds are heading south in January and February to enjoy the sunny weather, and they have citrus trees down there, but do you just stay home and look at your citrus trees all winter long?
Well, no, I have to bring them in because they just won't take the temperatures we have here. But right now I have them in my underground garage. It's attached to the basement, and I actually have lemons on my lemon tree. And they're turning yellow, although I would prefer them to turn yellow in the warmer part of the year because then they would have been a little sweeter. But it's been a job, but you can grow citrus in Michigan. Now, you're not going to supply all the citrus you need, but it's fun. Now, I don't have anything on my Tangelo tree yet because I had to cut it back because of a disease, but it's doing well right now and it's growing. So it's kind of a novelty to have a citrus tree in your front yard with citrus on it during the summer months, but that's what I had this year.
So Goodness,
how do you get them up your basement stairs to your front yard?
Well, they're in pots. The one pot is about 3.5 feet across, plastic pot, and I put them on runners and take them right out. I have to roll them out there. And one time I used to have a pot that was recessed in the ground, and then all I had to do was put the pot within the pot, and it looked like it was growing out of the ground. But the risk you take when you do that, if it's growing really well, is the roots can start to go down through the second pot and out of the drainage holes, and then it becomes more difficult to get it out. So if you're going to do that, you might want to put some gravel in the bottom of the pot that's in the ground, and then slip the pot in there. You won't have as much trouble getting it out. But you also have to realize that when you take that pot out and you still have the pot in the ground, you now have a little bit of a trap, and wildlife can fall into it. So you should have a round cover for it, so rabbits or something else won't fall in there and die.
So give our listeners an idea of what size these trees are, their height.
Well, right now the lemon tree is probably almost 6 feet tall, but I can keep it pruned to about my height. And actually that's a good thing because as you prune it, it causes it to do some side branching. And I think it's about two-year-old wood that produces the actual flowers. I have to go back and double check, but I'm pretty sure it's two-year-old wood, and that'll increase the yield surface area, as opposed to if you have a real leggy, a few branches, then you won't get as many fruit.
So tell us, Gary, do lemon flowers smell as nice as orange flowers?
No, orange blossoms, you really can tell. Lemons, I didn't notice it that much. When I had it inside, you could smell them, but they just aren't as pungent as oranges. And when we lived in an apartment, it was a townhouse, when the orange tree would bloom upstairs, you could smell it downstairs. But you would not be able to smell a lemon tree like that.
Yeah.
It was almost overwhelming. It was really a nice smell, though.
So your citrus trees, you mentioned lemons and tangelos. Is there anything else in your orchard?
No, not at the present time. I am going to order some mandarins. I do have a Cavendish banana growing right now, and I will probably start another one. I have three avocados, but they're nowhere near the size to even produce fruit yet. So that'll take some time. They're struggling. For some reason, they don't like Michigan very much. So I'm working on it. But I'll probably get at least mandarin. I don't think I'll get a grapefruit because they're really big and it's just too many trees to move around.
Mandarin sounds nice, though. I do like those little, in the store, I think they call them cuties, the little mandarins.
Yeah, that's a mandarin, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I really do like eating those. That would be a nice treat.
They have the cuties, and they have what they call the halos. And those are actually brand names. which they're not the variety name, they're a brand name. But one of the things I tried this last year is I bought a bunch of those and canned my own mandarin oranges. And the reason I did that is most mandarin oranges are coming out of China, almost everything you get. The only other mandarin oranges are coming out of Spain, and you can get them from Trader Joe's, but they're not cheap. I bought some on Amazon. They were like $5 for those little cans. But you can your own. There's a special enzyme that you buy that when you peel them, you soak them for about a day in this enzyme, and it causes all of the white stuff to come off of it so that they look like the mandarin oranges that you get in the store.
Oh.
And I would suggest if you are going to do it, do them in a medium syrup if you want them to taste like the ones in the store.
Now, Gary, you were talking about the way you manage your citrus trees indoors. You trim them when to be 6 feet or less, and that required pruning. And that's what you consider indoor pruning for these trees. But what about pruning outdoors?
Well, January, you can start pruning things like apples and pears. But I'm not going to talk so much about the details of pruning. I think I'll hold that off till it gets a little bit warmer. But what I want to talk about is making it more comfortable if you're going to go out there this time of year. And the reason I thought of that is my wife just bought me some new long underwear. And it's a real tight weave, and it's very smooth. And so I bought top and bottom. And when I go outside right now using that long underwear, I am quite comfortable, and I actually was getting a little warm when it was in the 30s. Of course, if you're moving around, you will get warm. But also, when you're out, try to dress in layers, which will help to keep you warm. But the things that get cold the fastest are your extremities, like your fingers, your toes, your ears. And if you keep the core part of your body warm, where, you know, your lungs and heart and all that stuff is, then your blood will keep circulating to the extremities. It's when your core starts to get cold, your body will try to keep the core warm at the expense of the extremities. And that's one of the reasons why your fingers get cold faster. But there are a couple of things that you can do when you get gloves. You can get insulated gloves, but sometimes that's not enough. But there are heating pads that you can put inside the gloves, and they're a liquid-filled gel, and you basically warm them up in warm water and then put them in your, dry them off, of course, put them in your gloves in a little case, and that'll keep your hands warm. You can also buy heated gloves. Now, that's expensive, but they will usually keep your hands warm for a good 4 or 5 hours, which is more than enough time to do some pruning. And those are electric, and they're running, I looked at some prices, they were like $150 to $180, so you have to really want to prune for that. Another thing you can do is just have some decent insulated gloves and use what they call these little chemical packs. And what I do is when I'm going to go out and prune, you just break one of these packets open and move it around, put it in your pocket, and they're good for about 7 to 8 hours. So when my fingers start to get a little cold, I would just take my gloves off and stick my hands in my pockets where those little packs were, and they would heat right up. So that'll take care of your extremities, and you can get heated socks also. But they have, if you get a good-sized boot so that there's some room for you to put on some nice thermal socks, you can keep your feet pretty warm. Now, another thing is hats. One of the things that doctors will tell you is that you're more likely to get a heart attack when you're shoveling snow if you're not wearing a hat.
Hmm.
And we lose heat through our head, but in the past people would say, oh, you can lose up to 50 to 80% of your body heat through your head. That's not true. I checked on WebMD, and they said it's about 10%. But still, if you want to stay warm, you don't want to be losing heat from your body. So what I do is I put on a double hat. I use a close-fitting hat, tight weave on my head, and pull it down over my ears. And then I'll get a bigger, fluffier hat to put on top of that hat. And I'll pull that one down over my ears also. And that keeps my head really warm, because anything with a tight weave will tend to keep that heat closer to your body. And then I use the bigger hat for insulation. And then, of course, if you're out during the winter and there's snow on the ground and it's a sunny day, it's not good for your eyes. And it's good to have sunglasses on to protect your eyes from direct sunlight, which can contribute to cataracts. And that's especially a problem if you're diabetic. You're more susceptible to getting cataracts. So you put all those things together, you can get out and be quite comfortable. Be sure you put a scarf around your neck so that wind can't go into your jacket. Of course, zip your jacket up. And I've learned these things the hard way. My wife is always after me. And I'd come in saying, I'm so cold. She said, zip your jacket, dummy. But anyway, those are all things that can be very helpful, and you'll be able to go out there and prune and actually enjoy the weather. Now, also take into consideration wind chill. If it's really a low wind chill, you do not want to stay outside long at all, because you can get frostbite very quickly when you have a low wind chill.
When you're properly dressed, how cold can you work outside comfortably?
You could be outside below zero, but my attitude is, if it's below zero, I'm going to just postpone it. But your hands will get cold when the temperatures are in the 20s, and so will your toes. So, but that's still good pruning weather, at least for the apples and pears. I like to wait for the plums and peaches and the apricots and nectarines until just before growth starts, just in case we get really cold weather. Now, in December, we had a snowstorm that came through here, and it was an Arctic blast coming down out of Canada, and their weather went below zero, but not enough to kill wood. But if you had a tree that was low in potassium, you might have lost some flower buds. But I don't draw any conclusions on that until just before buds are supposed to break, and then I'll check to see if there's been damage. Because, as we've said before, when the buds start to grow, you can get cold temperature damage at a higher temperature. So I don't worry so much about things when they're totally dormant, because they're the most hardy at that point.
Very good. Now, you have some new information on the All-American Selection winners.
Yeah, we had a few more coming out, and we'll see how many we can get through here. There was a squash, a winter squash out called Sweet Jade, and it's a kombucha squash, and it's one of those flat, round squashes. It gets about 1 to 2 pounds. Has a very dry textured flesh, high sweetness. And if you start it from seed, it's about 100 days from seeding to harvest. If you start it out as a transplant, cuts it down to about 85 days. The plants don't spread that much. They only spread about 6 to 8 feet. So that's an advantage. And this one was a national winner, which means that it grows equally well in any part of the country. And another vegetable that received a regional award was a tomato called Zenzei, spelled Z-E-N-Z-E-I. It's a paste tomato, and it received a regional award for the Great Lakes, which is the Michigan area, Indiana, Ohio, you know, Wisconsin, the Heartland, and it's an indeterminate type, which means it just keeps growing until frost, but it's a bushy indeterminate type. It only gets to be about 6 feet high, and the fruit size is about 4 to 5 inches long, so it's a pretty good size fruit for a paste tomato. Rated very good Roma tomato flavor, and you'll get about 30 to 50 tomatoes in a plant. So I'm going to try that one as soon as I can find some seed, but so far I've been looking at the catalogs that are that carry All America selections, and I've yet to find any of the new ones. Some of them, they say, yet to be released. And then there was a Snapdragon. It's a double, it's called Double Shot, and it's an orange bicolor, which looks more orange-red than specifically orange, but it could have been the lenses that they were using or the filters that they were using when they took the pictures. And this one is tolerant to both frost and a light freeze. And it doesn't get real tall. And this one is from first flower when you sow the seed. It's 77 days. If you grow from transplant, it's 42 days. And it has very strong stems, so strong, they said they'll hold up to hurricane force winds.
Hmm.
And it'll bloom all summer, even during the high temperatures. So that one also was an award winner for the nation. So it can be grown anywhere. The last one is also a national winner. It's called a taro or an elephant ear. It's a called Royal Hawaiian. I guess it's Waikiki. And this one is a deep green, glossy foliage with white markings, and the veins are a vivid pink. And they grow in a clump form. They get about 36 inches high. Very tolerant to heat. Now, this one is not available from seed, and they suggested that you go to a dealer that carries Monrovia brand plants, so you have to keep your eyes open for this one. It's a beautiful plant. I'm definitely going to look for this one.
Well, it sounds great. Well, folks, this concludes the January edition of Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig. Gary, would you give our listeners the information about your channels so that they can access that and gain more information?
Yeah, it's Gary Heilig, H-E-I-L-I-G. Just go to any web search, or if when you go to YouTube, just type my name in and it'll come up. And I'm currently working on some All America Selection video so you can actually see what they look like. And I'll be posting those over the next month.
Well, awesome. And if you have any questions that you would like to ask the Garden Guy, you can send them to me, Tom, at strongtowerradio.org. That's Tom at strongtowerradio.org. Well, this concludes the January edition of Good Growing with the Garden Guy. Your hosts, Tom and Sue Majeure, and of course, Gary Heilig is our subject matter expert. Stay tuned. You can go to our website to see past programs, or maybe going back a couple of years of seeing what we did in various months throughout the year and compiling that information. It's been our pleasure to present this program. It's a Strong Tower Radio production. Goodbye now.